Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about ecological education on the university level and about the fact that this is not just something that takes place in the classroom. I mean, certainly it does take place in the classroom. But there are people who argue that ecological lessons can be taught in a lot of other ways as well. And thinking about the environment can be reflected in the values that the campus promotes and also can be reflected in the built environment on the campus. And there are a lot of places in the country where they're starting to think more and more about these very issues. And we'll be talking this morning in this part of the show with someone who really is known as a pioneer in this area for his work on environmental literacy in higher education and also in ecological design. Our guest is David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Oberlin College. He's also the person who, perhaps more than anybody else, I'm sure a lot of people were involved in this effort, but he really was an important part of the effort to design and build the Environmental Studies Center there at Oberlin, which is a building that has been widely praised. The Energy Department said it was one of 30 milestone buildings of the 20th century. And the building itself, this is the Adam Joseph Lewis Center for Environmental Studies, has a website. So if you're interested in seeing what the building looks like and learning more about it, you can go to the Oberlin site, and then you can get to it from there. And it's really quite interesting. It's a nice website. You might want to take a look at it. Our guest, David Orr, is the author of a number of books, some of them dealing with, in fact, the design of this building. He's also contributing editor of Conservation Biology. He serves on the boards of the Rocky Mountain Institute and the Center for Ecoliteracy. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Orr, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. And yourself?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you being with us. You know, there is among my listeners, I know, at least one Oberlin alum who has been wanting us to do this show for a long time. So I'm glad you could talk with us. And I'm hoping that she's listening. Let's talk a little bit more about this idea of how a campus promotes environmental awareness and thinking, and particularly how that happens outside of the classroom setting?
Well, it's a good question. Campuses educate in all kinds of ways. They educate by the way they build, by how they landscape, how they purchase, and how they invest, and so forth. And most of those things have been thought to be not very important in the educational process. In fact, they're very important. And this generation of students needs to understand how systems work and how to in effect build great communities, operate on sunlight and efficient use of resources, and live within their ecological means. And a campus is such a terrific place to do this because it is, on one hand, it's large enough to be significant, a great place to experiment, but small enough to be manageable. So colleges and university campuses are terrific places to equip students in this next generation to know how to make the changes toward this big word called sustainability.
And I suppose that you also can't get away from the fact that colleges and universities have to be increasingly concerned with the costs of operation, and that saving money does enter into this.
Yes, very much. And I think those calculations are going to be more difficult for colleges and universities and investment managers to make as we come into an era in which the age of cheap portable fossil fuels is really over. And so the supply chains that stretch out for thousands of miles on which we become very dependent and so forth are going to change dramatically. Those costs are not going to be cheap anymore. And then the cost of climate change, we don't know yet, but we do know that those costs will be probably very large in the future.
Perhaps you might we might talk a little bit about the building, the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies. This obviously the building itself is intended to be a demonstration project to show what you can what a building can be, and also to do things like to try to make very obvious things like, well, what is the building's energy consumption? You know, for example, to name one thing, the idea is that the building itself, how it functions, its bones, its nervous system, is all supposed to be very visible, and to make people mindful of that of these things that ordinarily probably, unless maybe they're in this kind of field, they don't think about
right.
at all.
Right. Well, the problem, we began this in 1995, and this is before really the green building movement had risen to such tremendous national prominence. And we did this project as a way of involving people in the design of the built environment. So we had a series of open design meetings, what architects call charrettes, and maybe 250 or 300 people came into those charrettes at various times. And so the building reflected a good bit of dialogue before the architects were even involved with it. And coming out of the dialogue, students wanted a building that was powered entirely by sunlight and a building that emitted no waste product and made out of non-toxic materials and so forth. All the things that we now take as pretty standard in the ecological design field and in green building generally. But the largest idea, I think, that came out of this, we would take this acre and a quarter, including the landscape around the building and the building, its energy systems and water systems and so forth, and make this educational. And so by the way it was designed, built, operated, maintained, and as it evolved over time, this was taken to be an educational project. So the building is an experiment. It's also a laboratory. And it's a laboratory in the big issues of the 21st century. So it's, as far as I know, the only entirely solar-powered building on a U.S. college campus. And so energy systems are really important to us. And for this generation of students, this is really going to be critical. The flip side of that coin of climatic severe climate change is renewable energy and efficiency. And that was one of the core ideas of this particular building. The landscape around the building includes a restored wetland. It also includes orchards and gardens and so forth. So food production is on the agenda. There's a working landscape here. The building monitors itself. A colleague of mine, John Peterson, has organized an effort to make the monitoring system attractive and powerful. And you can go to the website and see how the building performs in real time in a variety of categories. That was part of a series of classes that we ran early on after the completion of the building. But the largest idea was to take this project and make this overtly, clearly instructional. And so it's not a typical building in that sense.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, David Orr. He's a professor of environmental studies and politics, chair of the environmental studies program at Oberlin College, and was very much involved in design and construction of this building he's just been talking about, the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies. If, by the way, you would like to read a book that he has written about the process of designing and making the building, you might look for his book, Design on the Edge, The Making of a High-Performance Building. It's published by the MIT Press and came out last year. Otherwise, as I mentioned, the building does have a website, so if you'd like to see what it looks like and learn some of the things about the building, you can do that. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you mentioned, I think that now there's a lot more interest in the idea of green building, but that when you first proposed and you started the process on this, there wasn't anything else like this. How was this met, particularly by the administrators of the university? How was the idea received?
Well, I think it was received all right. The terms of engagement were that money had to be raised from sources not otherwise likely to give to the college. And so this meant foundations, trustees, alums, anybody likely to give money to the college otherwise could not be approached to support this project. And so the funding sources had to be pretty well removed from the college. And that was fine because, David, I think if there are any fundraisers out there listening to this, they'll know that buildings are hard things to raise money for. They're just difficult. The national average is you can raise about half the money for campus buildings, but you have to borrow the other half. In this case, we had to raise all the money for the building. But you don't sell buildings nearly as easily as you sell ideas. And so the ideas behind this building that have now become so central to the green building movement and the U.S. Green Building Council and the American Institute of Architects and the sustainability movement generally, those were the ideas that were the core for this particular building.
I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this is that what you're trying to do is to make the use of energy something that's more visible so that then people will be aware of it. And I think that that's a real significant issue. That is, we don't really think about the amount of energy that we're using. How do you get a building to do that?
Well, in the first place, the energy systems for this building consist of two large photovoltaic arrays, one in the roof and one over the parking lot. And so that's visible right off the bat. And then secondly, when somebody comes into the atrium of the building display system displays energy, water, materials use, landscape, and so forth, a series of categories, and that is very visible. When people go to the website, they see the energy systems portrayed there. And this is part of the larger national issue, it seems to me, in addressing a smart energy policy, which again is the flip side of this coin of climate change. If we want to avoid the worst of what could lie ahead, we've got to forge a very smart, very well-crafted energy policy, first on efficiency, secondly on renewables in all their forms, wind, direct solar, biomass, microhydro, and so forth. But this, I think, is part of the educational task of our time, and that is to make people as rapidly as we possibly can aware of energy and really smart about energy use and energy accounting. We're through the era again of cheap portable fossil fuels, and so many things that we now rely on, coal and nuclear, have severe downsides. And so a smart energy policy is going to begin with a very different kind of set of assumptions, that we use it efficiently, we generate it from renewable sources.
I think that, that there is here, for example, I know in our area from time to time, we've talked about solar energy, and people have raised in the context of other programs, and that often the answer that we get back is, or that we're told by some people, is that it's just not, if you lived in the southwestern United States, that'd be one thing. There's plenty of sun. But if you live in the Midwest, it's a problem that there's not enough sun to really make using solar something that you can actually use. Now, you've said that this building is a good sized building. It's not a small building. Is entirely powered by solar energy. How is it that you managed to actually make that work?
Well, it's a great question, and it begs a really long answer, and you don't have the time for it. And your listeners wouldn't stand for it, but here's the problem, I think, in energy accounting. Mm-hmm. The cheapest, fastest thing we can do, both individually, generally, and as a nation for sure, is efficiency. We probably use twice as much energy as we really need to use. And this isn't sackcloth and ashes and back to the caves. This simply is the application of the most efficient technologies that we presently have available. And they are very cost effective. It's the cheapest and fastest thing we can do. Typically, Americans like to focus, however, on increasing supply. It's part of our national penchant for technology, which isn't all bad, but it directs us to the wrong side of the problem. If the accounting boundaries are set wide enough, then what appears to be cheap, for example, coal-fired electricity, is anything but cheap to the people of West Virginia, who have to live with the effects of mountaintop removal and strip mining and acid streams and these slurry ponds high up in the hills that drain down into towns and so forth. They live with the disadvantages. It's anything but cheap to the people who die prematurely from inhaling small particle pollution from coal-fired power plants to future generations, our addiction to cheap coal-fired electricity is going to be anything but cheap because they'll live under the changed climate conditions that we've bequeathed to them. So the word cheap is a loaded word, isn't it? And if the boundaries of consideration are wide enough to take into account all the cost of cheap electricity, it isn't cheap and never has been. And once the costs, all the costs are factored in, then photovoltaic electricity or wind electricity or efficiency, all these other options look a whole lot better. But it requires an honest accounting system that people are willing to pay the true cost of what they do in the world. And in California, for example, people pay much higher electric rates than they do in Ohio, where I live, but their average monthly bill is lower, and that is because the California Public Utilities Commission allowed for what's called demand-side management. And none of us really cares how many kilowatt hours of electricity we consume. We just want the beer kept cold and the butter cold and the showers hot and so forth. But if the utility can help us do that with maximum efficiency, then we can pay higher electric rates per kilowatt hour, but still have bills that are lower, and California is the proof of that. We know that that works.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that you were on the board of the Rocky Mountain Institute. This is Amory Lovin's outfit, and if people know anything about him, and we've had from time to time, I think we've had people associated with Rocky Mountain on the show, that one of the things that he has really been preaching, he and others, and here you've touched on it, is that we could go a long way to dealing with our energy problems by making certain that all of the devices that we use that use energy are as efficient as possible, and it is possible to do that and also maintain an acceptably comfortable lifestyle. I don't know whose phrase that was about the hot showers and the cold beers, but essentially that's it. You know, we don't. He would say, and I'm sure you would say, and other people would say, no, we don't have to be uncomfortable. It is possible to have all of those things and reduce our use of energy by making sure that we use our energy most efficiently as possible. Now, that might also mean going out and making sure your house is very well insulated and getting a new refrigerator and getting a new furnace and, you know, things like that. But that sounds like with what we know right now, that is all very doable.
I think that's exactly right. And Amory, for 30 years, has been really the national tutor and the best analyst on this subject. And he's a remarkably gifted analyst of energy. And I think history has proved him just dead right. And if you think of the cost of, the true cost of energy, if we factor in, for example, the cost of fighting oil wars into our price we pay for gasoline at the pump, the price of gasoline is going to jump considerably. And so when you do full cost analysis of something, you find out it really is in our interest as a nation to push technological creativity and renewables and avoid all the downside costs of fighting wars, dirty air, dirty water, degraded landscapes, and severe and rapid climate change. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really kind of a no-brainer. But the country, the part of the difficulty is I think the country, if you look at public opinion polls, is really ready for the change. Strong majorities favor renewable energy and all of its forms, and mandating more efficient appliance standards and increased auto efficiency standards and so forth. Difficulty is that there is no very large, well-funded lobby, as there is in the case of coal and oil, to push or to maintain this archaic energy system. And so the economics are distorted, and the politics are distorted, and we're stuck until leaders help us out of this morass. But the logic behind it has been so clearly stated by Amory Lovins and lots of other people for 30 or 40 years now.
Mm. Well, I suppose that there are some people who would argue that when it comes to the environment, for example, it's difficult, or at least it has been difficult, to get people to do the right thing simply because it's the right thing. And that if you're not going to have the government spearheading an appropriate energy policy, then the only way that you can get people to change their approach to energy use is by price. If you hit them in the pocketbook, then you're going to get people's attention. But until then, until that point, it's very difficult to get a large number of people to start thinking differently. Do you think that that's true?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are people like you and I that will do things where we're going to be the leading edge of the radical fringe or whatever. And there are people who start off revolutions, but to come up that slope toward is called a tipping point, I think you really do need government policies. And particularly in the case of fossil fuels, we need a price on carbon. And I think, fortunately, the awareness of this is beginning to change in Congress. There are 4 or 5 major bills in Congress aiming to either tax carbon or create a cap-and-trade system. I think the logic of it is slowly dawning on people, but we do need federal and state policies. And in the absence of that, moral suasion just isn't going to move the public. And I think in the case of business, business needs to understand what the playing field is going to be like 10 or 20 years out. And if policy is going to change every 2 or 3 years, and they simply can't do long-term planning, and neither can colleges or universities. So I think it's very important to have public policies that are far-sighted enough, and everybody can plan on gradually increasing or escalating cost of fossil fuels and certain kind of incentives for moving toward renewables and mass transit and rail systems and all the things that we need to do to avoid climate disaster.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest for this hour, David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics. He's also chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Oberlin College and is well known for his work in environmental literacy in higher education and also ecological design. He was very important in raising money for and spearheading the effort to design and build the Adam Joseph Lewis Center for Environmental Studies at Oberlin, a building that has been very highly praised. And as he says, he thinks, as far as he knows, this was really the very first building of its kind, the first, one of the first, if not the first, substantially green or high-performance building on a college campus. He's written a number of books, and there's one that deals specifically with this building and how it came to be. And if you're interested in learning about that, you can look at that book. It's titled Design on the Edge, The Making of a High-Performance Building, and it's published by the MIT Press. Also, the building itself has a website, so you, if you have internet access, you can go there. You can see what the building looks like, and you also can look at the building and how it works and its energy consumption. You can see all that displayed in real time. That's part of the idea, that the building shows you these things, so you can take a look at that on the website. Questions are welcome here on the program, Focus 580-333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, and I think we got some callers lined up. We'll go first to someone here on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. My pet energy wasting peeve is these large private homes. People call them McMansions. And I had occasion to call in and ask someone in the mortgage business how come the bankers are giving mortgages to these energy wasting, overly large homes. And he said, oh, don't blame us, blame the appraisers. So have you looked into the various home appraisal criteria in which a value is assigned to a home for taxing based on more criteria than just square footage, in which the appraiser would have to find out how much insulation and how efficient the heating and air conditioning systems are, and possibly other criteria?
Well, thanks for the question. I have not, but I think it's a very, very good point. And we don't have, as a country, a national building code. There are separate codes. There's an ASHRAE code, and there are standards from the U.S. Green Building Council and the American Institute of Architects, but we don't have a national building code. I think that we probably need one. But appraisers and bankers, an energy-inefficient home has a higher likelihood of ending up in a banker's bad loan portfolio And so this is a matter of some interest to people who lend money for housing. And it seems to me that they ought to be paying attention, and I think in some cases are beginning to pay more attention to energy efficiency and the life cycle energy costs of the homes for which they're providing the initial financial means.
Oh, and I just want to compliment you on giving another great chapter in the life of Oberlin College.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yes, go ahead.
In terms of the, sun, or what do you call it, passive solar heating was used too or not in the building?
The building is both passive and active, yeah.
Okay. But in terms of the photo, cells and all that?
Yeah.
Currently, they brought that up to, my understanding, about 15%. Is that correct?
You mean in terms of efficiency?
Yeah, right.
If I understand correctly, the lab efficiencies are up over 30%. There are, in terms of commercial systems, I think you can probably buy things in the high teens at 17, 18, 19%.
Now, what about your building, because of, being built?
Well, we have two different arrays, and if I remember the numbers correctly, and I may not, the first array was manufactured by BP Solar. It is just a tad under 14%. The second array, which was installed a few years later, is around 16%.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, if there had been, if we'd gotten into this earlier, the efficiency could have even been higher than that. It's based on a lot of manufacturing too, right? I mean, the more you would sell of these, the prices would come down. It's fairly expensive, right?
Oh yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think the first, if the U.S. Department of Defense or a large buyer like Walmart with literally millions and millions of square feet decides to go to solar, that decision will change both the economics and the efficiency numbers very quickly.
And then finally, what about the R factor? That's a big one in terms of efficiency, the insulation.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the R factor on this building?
We've got the walls of the building are around 22 to 24. The ceiling is right at 40. And if I were doing this particular building over again, I think I would recommend increasing the R factor. The glazing has gotten better. The technology for buildings and also for home construction and home retrofits has gotten considerably better in the past 5 or 6 years. And so the advice to anybody building, I think, is to make as tight a shell as you can make while still making it the kind of building you want to be in. You don't want to build caves. And we did pay, in this case, we put glazing on the east side of the building. You'll notice if you go to the website, the pictures, you see the building. And that was a choice that we made, knowing that the building would be, there'd be an energy penalty for that. But Oberlin tends to be a pretty cloudy place. We have a lot of lake effect clouds. So we have about as many sunny days or cloudy days as the city of Seattle. It was a very conscious decision to make this a lighter building rather than a darker building.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks,
thanks for the question.
We had someone off the air wanting to know about the website, which I've mentioned now a couple of times. I think probably the URL is kind of long, so I think the easiest thing for anyone to do if you'd like to find this website is just put into your browser Lewis Center for Environmental Studies, and you can find it. Or you can go through the main webpage of Oberlin College one way or another. So it's not difficult to find, and it really is a nice website. And questions are welcome, too. If someone wants to call in here, talk with our guest David Orr from Oberlin College, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd just like to return to this idea of how it is that getting people to think about environmental issues and sustainably, students, getting them to think about that beyond the classroom. If, for example, people are studying environmental studies, that's the subject of the classroom discussion. But ways that you can get this, get students to think about this, and I suppose it does have something to do with things like, getting them to recycle and turn off the lights when they're not in the room and perhaps use mass transit, or, maybe is it more complicated than that?
Well, I think those are all good places to start. And environmental education, I think, ought to be built into the kind of the warp and woof of the society. It ought to be not just something that environmental educators do or universities do. I think when Walmart began its greening, corporate greening program, for example, all of a sudden Walmart became a pretty powerful educational force. Millions of people shop at Walmarts, whether you like them or not. People go into Walmarts, and when Walmart begins to advertise energy-efficient lighting systems or toxic-free kinds of things or organic food, it does have an effect on people. And the same was true with this famous company started by Ray Anderson, Interface Carpet Corporation. Ray set out years ago to become a carbon-neutral company, and they're, I think, have eliminated, I don't know, maybe 90% of the carbon emissions that the company had before they started, and still making a great profit and a terrific product. And so when he did that, all of a sudden, here's another corporation that becomes educational, very instructive to not just people in business, but to their buying public and to the public at large. But I think this environmental education entails really two major things. One is equipping people to see systems and patterns. What's related to what? And if you do this over here, what happens downstream? And then secondly, equipping people to think longer term, that we think about our children in longer term sense. And I think environmental thinking is very much the same kind of thing that you would do typically as a good parent or a church member or whatever, but thinking in terms of systems and longer time horizons.
I think that's not, it seems to me that it's not as, particularly the first, getting people to think about systems, is not as easy as it might sound, at least in the sense that I think that there is greater awareness that we're facing serious environmental issues and that they are global in scale. And for that reason, I think that a lot of people say, well, yes, I understand we have these big issues, but what can I, as an individual, in my daily life, do about this? Does anything that I'm going to do one way or another really make very much difference?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways in which it clearly does. One is that people vote with their dollars as well as their ballots. And to begin to buy Energy Star appliances, hyper-efficient cars, and better insulated houses and so forth, these are standard kinds of things that are very obvious, and they have the benefits of saving money and doing the right thing, starting markets for better kind of services that we need to create. Buying locally, buying from local farmers, and buying organic produce. I mean, all these things, the way we buy is critically important. And then there's another factor here, and it is the other way in which we express opinions, and when we go into the marketplace of politics, we voted for a lot of people in this country who simply don't understand or didn't understand the reality of the way the world works as a physical system. And so the climate skeptics fed on a good bit of it, frankly, not to put too fine a point on it, that this wasn't real and the climate scientists were in dispute about it and so forth. And people needed to vote at a higher level and put higher caliber people into office, people who, in fact, were scientific and worked as a physical system, and why that was important for things like national security and economy and equity and fairness. Environment, David, is not just, this is a sermon, but it's not just an item on a list. It's the linchpin that holds that list together. If you get environmental things wrong, get an energy policy wrong, for example, your air is going to be dirtier, your water is going to be dirtier, you'll be fighting oil wars, a less vibrant and robust economy. And so I think people can do two things, and it's how they express opinions in a market economy and in a democracy, and that is to vote for people who care about these things and are equipped to understand them.
Just as a practical matter, if one of the things that we're encouraging people to do is to change the hardware in their life so that it's more energy efficient, that may mean paying money up front to save money later. If the only thing you're thinking about is the bill for your energy, and there are some people who will say, okay, I get that. I pay now, but I save later. I think not everyone is susceptible to that kind of an argument. Do you have to provide some kind of incentive up front to get people to make the investment that returns later?
Well, I think so sometimes. divide that into two categories. People typically want to invest or put money in a bank account or a stock market or whatever, and you look at rates of return. And a good many of the things that we can do environmentally have very quick rates of return. Energy efficiency is the top of the list. We know how to make houses energy efficient, and when you do that, for example, the rate of return looks a whole lot like a very, very good investment. For longer-term kinds of changes, here's where public policy comes in. A utility, for example, has an investment horizon of maybe 20 years. They want their money back in maybe two decades, where most customers and ratepayers want their money back in 2 or 3 years. But imagine public policy that allows us to piggyback one rate of the customer's preference for a quick rate of return with the utility's capacity to have a slower rate of return. And public policy is necessary, I think, to make those kinds of things easy for the customer. Tax changes, giving people tax credits as we once had in the 1970s, canceled by the Reagan administration, for solar tax credits. The solar industry was beginning to boom in the 1970s and early 80s until the tax credit was not renewed. And those kinds of things allow people to do smart or make smart energy choices that are good for the country, good for security, good for economy, but it requires far-sighted public policy.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we have a couple of callers here. Let's go to the phones again. The next person to talk with is in Sullivan, and this is line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah. Years ago, there was a company in New York State or some East Coast state by the name of Compression Labs, and it used a high-compression sodium bulb or something of that nature, which shot produced light that went down a tube, and they were saying that they could use, we'll say, 10 light bulbs to light up a Walmart store compared to all the lights there. Have you ever heard of that company? And if so, whatever happened to them?
I'm not sure I have. I don't know if I can answer that question.
It was about 8 years ago. I read an article in some magazine, and I called and, you know, talked to them a little bit. And that was it. And I was just kind of curious, but I thought, well, you know, that'd be a heck of a deal. You light the whole Walmart store with just a few of these bulbs compared to what they have.
Yeah, that's a new one on me. I'd like to know more about it.
Well, Compression Labs is a company.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whatever happened to it. It was just I just saw it in the paper someplace and read about it and called them. That's been long ago. Okay, thanks.
All right, well, I appreciate the comment.
Let's go on to another call here. This is someone here where we are in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I think one of the biggest problems is that we're graduating people from high school and college that are clueless about what's happening in the environment. This university graduates probably more engineers than about anybody in the country, and none of those kids have had any biology, ecology, or thought about any of this kind. Not none, because there's a few of them that know. They don't know what sustainability means. I think that maybe all new freshmen should have a course so they realize there are issues in buildings, in products, in the things that they do when they graduate. I notice that MIT's engineers graduate and sign a sustainability pledge, or they are asked to sign a sustainability pledge so that people are being educated to think about what's happening around us and not design a car or a computer or a building that does not take all these important issues into account.
I couldn't agree more. Illinois, University of Illinois there has some wonderful people on issues of sustainability. Bruce Hannon, a friend of mine.
Oh, absolutely.
Bill Sullivan, Eric Freifogel, Clark Bullard. I mean, you got some terrific people there. And I think it'd be
and I know all those names. It needs to be translated into requirements to graduate, which is a big, heavy issue, because otherwise people don't elect to do some of these things. They don't ever have to learn about them.
I think that's a great point. I couldn't agree more. And I think there are ways in which university chancellors and presidents can incentivize faculty to step out and offer those kind of courses and make those kind of changes.
Okay, I agree, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing, that you've done at your school. I just wish we could catch up with you somehow.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome here. We have maybe about 10 minutes, a little bit less, left in this part of Focus 580 with David Orr. He is a professor of environmental studies and politics. He's also chair of the environmental studies program at Oberlin College and has been working in this area, working on environmental literacy and higher education for a long time. And also, as we've mentioned, he was very important in the design and the construction of the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies there on the campus, a building that he says may well be the first, if not one of the first, green buildings on a university campus anywhere in the country. And again, if you're interested in reading about what went into the design and construction of that building, you can look for his book, Design on the Edge, The Making of a High-Performance Building, and it's published by the MIT Press. And I think we're getting some other callers lined up here. Let's go on to someone here, I think, on line number one. Yes, hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
Okay. As far as sustainability, we recently had a rate hike, an electric rate hike here in the area, and I have almost all compact fluorescents in my house, and I'm very, very conservative in terms of energy, and I actually saw very little increase in my electric bill. It was, I think it was close to 100% increase.
Wow.
In the area. So you really can do a lot. I mean, naturally, it went up some, but if you are very conservative in what you use, and I did run the air conditioner some this summer, so I'm not sure it was that good in the summer, but it started, I think, January 1st, and in the winter, I saw very little increase.
Well, you've been smart. To help people make those kind of changes, California raised its electric rates, allowed the utility to make more money, but then did what's called demand-side management, which is the systematic effort to try to encourage customers to do the most efficient kinds of things. And some utilities have gone into the efficiency business, helping people buy energy-efficient refrigerators and air conditioners and so forth, so that their rate can go up, but their actual bill stays pretty level. And that makes explicit good sense as we move toward a very different energy era. But thanks very much for that comment.
Welcome.
All right, and we'll go on to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I have some information for the very first caller to this program, the fellow who was concerned about the continual building of inefficient houses. For his information and others who have the same concern, we have right here in Urbana a group called Ecolab, which is one of the pioneering groups in the country for building efficient houses. And they're finishing their third house, and they have hopes for doing lots more. But they're a very small 501c3 organization operating on a shoestring. And you can find them in the phone book or on the Internet. And they sure could use some help and input. And I just wanted to get that information out to folks who wanted to help in that way.
Well, thanks
okay.
Very much.
Very good. Well, in that case, then we'll continue and we'll talk with somebody else here. And that would be a caller who is in Urbana, line three. Hello. So, caller there in line three in Urbana?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I'm
go ahead.
Line three, excuse
yes.
me.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm an Oberlin alumna, and I'm very proud of Oberlin, very proud of David Orr. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Please comment further on this business of one person saying, "What can I do? I'm alone." Well, if that person were really alone, he couldn't do anything. But he's part of a huge population, and so little by little, individuals are going to be able to do something. Please comment.
Well, it's a great question. You know, imagine if Moses has said, "I'm only one," or Martin Luther King or Mother Teresa or any number of people you could name. I mean, we can all opt out and say that I'm only one person and I can't do much. But in fact, the power of one person standing up and beginning to make very different decisions and choices is very powerful and very instructive. So your question begs an answer that says we all have power to do this. But ultimately, the power of individuals has got to be translated upward into a movement. In the case of Martin Luther King, who stood up, it was a civil rights movement. Muhammad Gandhi, it was a nonviolence movement, and so forth. But these things need to be organized into a much larger effort. And the beauty of this issue of sustainability is that there really is no downside to it. It represents changes that we'll have to make anyway. The sooner we make them, the more effective they'll be. We can rebuild prosperity around an economy based on sunlight and local resources and so forth, and that's win-win all the way across the board. But thanks for that comment, and thanks to a fellow Oberlinian.
All right. Well, that's I thank you also. And let's go to Chicago for another call. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I was wondering if the National Organization Habitat for Humanity has been able to incorporate any of these suggestions that you and other groups have been trying to have prevail. Do you know of any attempts on their part?
I don't know a great deal about Habitat for Humanity. I've heard that they're building some energy-efficient houses. And I don't know. I don't really know much more than that. I've just heard that by the grapevine that there are some movement, but
or if they're just building a traditional dwelling, you know, without regard, of course, the cost and all the other factors well into it. And another general question: years ago, some buildings, including office buildings, that were built underground to maintain a stable temperature and therefore reduce the need for energy input into the buildings. How is the underground construction stand these days?
You know, the University of Minnesota School of Architecture years ago promoted a lot of earth-sheltered homes, and I think that they work fine. They create problems of moisture. They have to be ventilated. They have to be built very carefully to make sure the walls are stable. Underground, what's called hydrostatic pressure, is a difficult thing to deal with, and so construction is a little trickier. But it does allow you, or does allow the homeowner or building owner, to take advantage of the insulating effect of several feet or more of earth.
I heard there's some commercial buildings on that order, too. I think a few years ago, one of the data processing, I think Ross Perot was connected with it, up in Minnesota somewhere. They had a building underground.
Yeah, that's one I'm not sure I recall, but there's a... I think the movement has faded a little bit.
Yeah,
but I'm not quite sure why. The cost may be a little higher, maybe more difficult to go back and fix problems. But moisture is going to be moisture and darkness are going to be the two issues for.
The next great area for building, even on a temporary basis, is the displacement that's occurring as a result of natural disasters, like Katrina, and now we see the forest fires on the West Coast and so forth. So temporary shelters are just going up willy-nilly on whatever ad hoc basis. And you wonder what kind of a effort they could make for that. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the question.
Well, let's take one more call here. Paris, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Just a point that I'd like to make. I know a lot of people are encouraging people to use the energy-efficient light bulbs, and I read an article recently in Scientific America that brought up a very good point that, and a lot of the public may not be aware of it, that those bulbs contain a minute amount of mercury, and there is no recycling program, at least in our area, for those kind of products. And you have everybody encouraging the public to use them, but a lot of the public doesn't realize that those need to be handled with care and properly disposed of. And I think that's something, before we keep encouraging people to use those, that those issues need to be addressed before we just dump them into a landfill. And poof, they're gone, which they're not really gone. They're still there, and the mercury's still there. And even though it's a minute amount, yours, mine, and ours all ends up being more. So it was just a point I'd like to make, and I'd like to hear your comment on it. Thank you. Bye.
Well, I think the question is a very good one. I think the there is a movement to have the vendors or sellers of those kind of light bulbs take them back and sponsor recycling programs. I know this has been, I believe this has been under consideration at Walmart, may actually have been done there. The larger part of your question is to say that the life cycle cost of various kind of goods and services ought to be factored into the price and into the production system. And so if a company makes a particular kind of thing, like a light bulb or even a car, it comes back to that company for disassembly and remanufacture.
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Just one more time, I want to thank our guest, David Orr. He's professor of environmental studies at Oberlin College and, as we've mentioned, was very much involved in the construction of this building, the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies. Have a nice website. You can just put that into your browser or go through the Oberlin webpage. And if you're interested also, you can look at some of the books that our guest has written that have to do with environmental and sustainability issues. Professor Orr, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thank you very much.